on your mobile apps on 97.8. And now on DAB. This is Gateway.
From the Sky News Centre at 5, the Foreign Office says it's in contact with Italian authorities after two British nationals died in a cable car crash. Another two tourists were also killed, with a fifth seriously injured. The wires snapped, sending the lift crashing to the ground near Naples. Umberto De Gregorio, the president of operator EAV, says an investigation will now take place.
Before opening the cableway, there were 3 months of tests, and then the checks are repeated every morning. The ropes are subjected to x-rays and checks. Everything we had to do was done. Evidently something went wrong. We don't know what, whether an exceptional unforeseen event or human error.
The US Vice President says he's confident an agreement can be reached to end the war in Ukraine. The comments from J.D. Vance counter those of the Secretary of State, who suggested America could walk away if there was no progress in talks. Russia's envoy to the UN, Vasily Nebenzia, isn't optimistic about stopping the fighting.
We had an attempt on a limited ceasefire on energy infrastructure, which was not observed by the Ukrainian side. So in these circumstances, to speak about ceasefire is simply unrealistic at this stage.
A man's died trying to cross the English Channel in what Kent police are calling a medical emergency. The RNLI's confirmed it helped to bring migrants to the shore off Dover this morning. The Defence Secretary is promising to stop the rot in military housing. John Healey wants to improve living conditions for families in the armed forces. A 4-foot caiman, which is similar to an alligator, has been seized after a police search in Essex. Officers also found a significant amount of cannabis and weapons at the property in Aveley. And Britain's Lando Norris has finished second fastest in the first practice session for this weekend's Saudi Arabian F1 Grand Prix. Pierre Gasly topped the timesheets in Jeddah. That's the latest. I'm Kat Suave.
This is 40-year-old Kathy, mother of two and self-confessed telly addict.
Ready? Oh, look at you. That's brilliant. Well done.
This is also Kathy, working as part of a team to keep things calm at her local prison.
Come on. Come on. Listen, speak to me.
And helping someone's son write his first letter home in 8 months.
Well done. You should be really proud.
Thank you, miss.
An extraordinary job done by someone like you. Search prison jobs now.
I love listening to music. Listen to it all the time.
It just puts a smile on your face.
Now on DAB across Essex. Across Essex.
All right, you got it.
This is Gateway.
I could be wrong.
Public Image with Rise. This is Gateway 97.8. Hello there, I'm Johnny Jenkins, and you're listening to My Life in Print with Aidan McGurran, who's with me in the studio. Hello, Aidan. Good to see you.
Good to be here.
So, for the listeners that don't know you then, why are you on a programme called My Life in Print?
Because that's where I spent most of my life, print newspapers. It makes me feel old already as soon as you even mention print newspapers. But for 20-odd years of my career, I worked at the Daily Mirror, finishing up as managing editor of Mirror Group Newspapers.
Where did it all start?
It all started by accident, really. I was at university in Manchester, had no clue what I wanted to do. One of my best friends at uni was working on the student newspaper and roped me in to get involved. And
they're quite big things on campus, aren't they?
Yeah, no, the Manchester University one, Mancunian, was and is still quite a very big thing. So that got me interested. I really loved being involved writing, doing news stories, reviews, etc. And decided that was for me. And after university, worked for a little while in various jobs to try and save some money to do my journalism course. Didn't save much money, but did end up doing the journalism course.
Do you remember what the first story you did for the Mancunian, what that was?
To be honest, I don't remember the first story I did for Mancunian. I think a lot of stuff I was doing was actually like music reviews and things like that, film and music. So I don't remember the first story, but I remember my getting in. Again, I had a big interest in music, so it was nice picking the music for today. And getting my name in the New Musical Express was one of my first bylines, and that was a bit. That was a big thrill. And also the Face magazine as well. So, but then I went into... ditched all the music and went into straightforward news reporting.
Whilst we're on the music then, Public Image Rise. Yeah. You've picked the music, as you mentioned. Why that one to start with?
I love John Lydon, I'll be honest. I was kind of 13, 14 when the whole punk thing exploded. So obviously at that age, it was kind of a massive thing. Loved the Sex Pistols. But I thought John Lydon, in terms of his stuff with Public Image, was really challenging and, you know, groundbreaking, and it hasn't always been given the credit he deserves. And he just makes me laugh as well, because he's really funny.
He's been getting into politics a bit yeah, recently as well.
Yeah.
Maybe the different side of the aisle to you.
Yeah, no, I mean, I must have been a bit surprised, but I think the thing with John Lydon is he's a great contrarian. You never quite know when he's being serious and when he isn't. So I think what he does do is kind of challenge people's orthodoxies and opinions. And sometimes on the left, I'll be honest, you know, there can be a sort of lazy attitude to politics, so sort of challenging your opinions now and again is no bad thing, but I'm not sure I always believe him either.
That description you give of him sounds to me tabloid, which there's this idea of being controversial at times. Winding people up a little bit, not always sure if that's where the writer themselves stands, but there's obviously truth in there as well. He's a great tabloid man then, isn't he?
No, he is. I don't know if you'd appreciate that description himself, but he is a great tabloid man, yeah. And, you know, in his early days, you know, when the old punk thing happened, he was hardly off the front page for several years. I mean, there's a great Mirror front page, the Filth and the Fury, after what it was actually Steve Jones in the Sex Pistols, not John, who swore on live TV. So I'll try not to do that on radio.
No, please don't. You mentioned that byline, so that's when...
Yeah,
we'll try as we go along to break down these terms, which maybe we're both used to. But that's obviously when you see your name, your name in print.
Yeah,
that's the most amazing thing, especially seeing it at the start, isn't it?
I think early on, especially, it's a massive thrill. You know, so I started off on a small daily local newspaper in Oldham, the Oldham Evening Chronicle, which sadly doesn't exist anymore, which is a great shame. And, you know, just to see your name in print in a local paper, it's just it's a massive thrill. And I don't think you kind of lose that, actually. I mean, obviously you get used to it more, but I don't think you lose it. And that, you know, particularly when you do get onto national newspapers and see your name on the front of a national newspaper, particularly for me when I got to the Daily Mirror, because it was the paper I grew up with. My dad always got the Daily Mirror. It was our paper. So that was a real thrill. And my dad actually started buying it, because when I worked for the Sun, I found out subsequently he did buy it occasionally if I had a fairly substantial article in there, but he was very reluctant to buy the Sun.
People are really tribal, aren't they, with their papers? They've bought the same one, as you say, is a Mirror Man.
Very much so, yeah. My dad arrived over from Ireland in 1949, and I think from then on until the day he died, bought the Daily Mirror every single day. But he was a bit of a news junkie, so in a way it's not that surprising how I became a journalist. It's just surprising it didn't occur to me a bit earlier. Really.
Let's do the next track, Public Enemy, Fight the Power. Tell us why you picked this one.
a big Public Enemy fan. I went through a period of sort of late 80s, almost exclusively listening to hip hop. I thought Public Enemy were head and shoulders above most of the rest, and you know, it's a little bit political as well.
Okay, this is My Life in Print with Ada McGurran and Johnny Jenkins. Here we go.
Best educated, best equipped, best prepared troops refuse to fight. Matter of fact, it's safe to say that they would rather switch than fight.
From Public Enemy, Ada McGurran is here telling us his life in print. That's political, that song, as you mentioned. So when did you first sort of feel political or feel you were getting that way?
Well, I mean, it's interesting because the two big things in my life from early on were politics and then a bit later news. But I actually joined the Labour Party at 15, so I was quite an early starter.
Who was the leader then?
Who was the leader then? It would have still been Callaghan. Been James Callaghan. So what prompted me was less James Callaghan and more one Margaret Thatcher prompted me. So who was not universally popular in the northwest of England,
no, of
fair to say. So so I joined the party at 15. I've been a member pretty much ever since.
So getting into the Mirror at first, you mentioned you've been on local, you've been a student paper, you've been on local paper. Well, how did you get your first foot into the national?
So I think from the point I was on the Oldham Evening Chronicle, I started giving... it was actually mainly The Sun, because one of the, my former colleagues at the Oldham Chronicle was then working at The Sun, started giving them tips and bits of stories and stuff, so they they became aware of me, and then I did a few shifts for them. And then, when, after the Oldham Chronicle, worked for a news agency in Liverpool called Mercury, who supplied all the national newspapers, broadcast, TV and radio as well. So learnt a lot there, and then moved to London and started shifting at The Sun, got a job at The Sun, and actually it wasn't really Aidan McGurran that moved to The Mirror, because I became the National Lottery correspondent at The Sun.
Yes.
I'd had to use the name Lenny Lottery, somebody in The Sun. So it was Piers Morgan, who was then the editor of The Mirror's great idea to poach Lenny Lottery from The Sun to The Mirror, and being, as I said, being a Mirror man, that was a hard offer to refuse. Although, to be fair, I should say I've really enjoyed my time at The Sun and learnt more there than at any other period of my journalistic career, to be honest, in terms of as a journalist.
People have got really strong opinions about The Sun in particular.
Yeah.
Called The Scum, isn't it, in some parts of this country.
Yeah.
After the whole Hillsborough thing and the front page that said the truth, and we don't need to get into whether they should have published that front page or not, but... once you actually look at the paper itself, if you can get past that, it's a great paper. Yep. So much in it. So many sort of fresh stories, great pictures. But people are so sort of worried about even touching it sometimes, aren't they?
I mean, I can understand, certainly in Liverpool, obviously, to this day, it's still a big thing. And, you know, there are other issues to do with other stories and whatnot. But I can only say, like, I really enjoyed my time there. You know, and people have people have misconceptions about The Sun. It was and is, or can be, a great product. I work with some of the best journalists I've ever worked with in my life, who were also very generous with the time. They were a lot more experienced than I was at the time. I was just starting off. They were incredibly generous with the time and encouraging. And also a lot of them, politically, were not what you'd expect. They were left of centre. And sometimes use the analogy with football. You know, you don't end up necessarily playing for the football team you support, and you don't necessarily end up working for the newspaper that aligns with your own views. I mean, I was lucky because I learned a lot there and then moved on to The Mirror. But so I was very fortunate in that respect.
You mentioned learning a lot there. The art of tabloid papers is to get the same story down to a very small word count, isn't it?
Yeah.
And to pack it in, cut the waffle.
Yeah.
That's something which is a massive thing you learn, isn't it, in tabloid news?
No, it is, because on a local paper, it's you've got a bit more space, a bit more room. A lot of stories in tabloid newspapers are cut down to tiny, tiny pieces of copy. So you've got to be quite ruthless. It's a steep learning curve. People go on about journalism being a profession. I prefer the term trade. I think you learn your trade. But I think people obsess about the writing, and the writing's important. But I think the biggest thing about being a tabloid journalist is learning how to deal with people and get people to talk to you, who probably it's not in their interest to talk to you, but to get them, because if you don't get those interviews, those discussions going, you don't have a story usually,
and it's you don't have the exclusives which you're being demanded of the whole time.
Yeah, and you really are demanded, particularly at The Sun at that period. The demand to bring in exclusives was very strong, and then when I went to The Mirror, Piers Morgan was there and he liked an exclusive.
So what was he like as an editor?
To be fair, I mean, again, I wouldn't claim to know him as an individual terribly well. We certainly didn't hang out much, that's for sure. But he was a great editor from a personal point of view, because at that time I was the East of England district reporter. Anything happened in East of England was down to me. It was a period where there was a lot of big stories, and I did, at risk of blowing my own trumpet, did bring in quite a few exclusives. So if you were bringing in exclusives with Piers Morgan, he was fine. If you weren't, maybe not so good.
He was a really young editor, wasn't he?
Yeah, yeah. I think he was 27 when he edited the News of the World, which is just ridiculous. It's just absolutely ridiculous. So he's like still only in his 30s when he was editing The Mirror. So, I mean, whatever you think of him as an individual, and opinions vary, he has had a phenomenal career. And despite what people think about him as an individual as well, I don't think you can really dispute he's a very, very good journalist.
I'm just trying to get the timeline right. So you're Lenny, is it Lenny the Lotto Man?
Lenny Lottery, yeah.
Lenny Lottery, okay. And that's at the Sun?
That's at the Sun, but carries on for about a year and a half.
So he sort of buys you over, and that's a classic Piers Morgan publicity stunt, is it?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, because to be fair, I mean, the thing is, I've been writing about the lottery for about 3 years, and initially it was massive. It was, people were obsessed with it. But it was kind of, you know, becoming a little bit old hat. So actually, in a way, it was probably the wrong time to get, but it did kind of breathe a bit of life into it, because the Sun and the Mirror got all ridiculously territorial about the lottery. They then invented a Sir Lenny Lottery by my former colleague Brian Flynn, who I don't think was too thrilled about that. But so there was a kind of lottery war between the Sun and the Mirror for about a year, and eventually I was allowed to return to being Aidan McGurran and write about general news stories.
This is it. You're a journalist, obsessed with politics, interested in the news, and you're writing about the lottery under a different name.
Yeah.
Some might look down on that, or will it be a bit snobby and say that's not what you got into it for?
Some people did and were very snobby about it, and almost treated you as though you're a bit of a, you know, a bit infantile or something. You weren't that intelligent, and so that got on, I must admit, that side of it got on my nerves. But what you've got to remember is, when the lottery was first launched, it was massive. I mean, I think the week the lottery went live, 5 out of 6 days, it was the splash in the front page story in the Sun. So
what would it say? You know, 6682. Here's your numbers today.
I mean, it was anything. I mean, to be fair, getting a splash out of the lottery early on wasn't difficult.
Right.
And of course, then when you started having winners, there were great stories, because, you know, again, people forget, we'd had the pools before that, but the kind of sums involved in some of the lottery wins were just massive compared to what we'd seen before. So, you know, people going from being a factory worker to being a multimillionaire. So obviously it generated a lot of interesting stories.
I always find it slightly odd when people decide to reveal their identity. Yeah. You've just won millions of pounds. Yeah. Why do you want to shout about it? Is that because they'd be given more money to give stories?
No, actually not. I think the main reason people did it is not revealing your identity poses certain difficulties as well. So, you know, your natural instinct is to tell people about your good fortune, share some of your good fortune maybe. So I think early on people were more inclined to go public. I think over time they got became a bit more guarded, because I'll be honest, you know, some of the lottery winners, some of the stories weren't always positive. So it wasn't, you know, some it was a happy experience, some it wasn't. So, I think, but, you know, what amazes me, if you win like 20, 30, 40 million pounds, keeping that quiet's pretty difficult.
Yeah, true.
You know, that's quite difficult.
And then you get the great category of story of, you remember that multimillionaire from a couple of years ago, they're now bankrupt and they're back where they were and they've wasted it all. That happened quite a lot.
That happened quite a bit, yeah. No, there's a few spectacular ones like that, yeah. Yeah. I can't remember his name now, but yeah, one of the early winners was a young guy who spunked it spectacularly and ended up, you know, I think he was, he might have been working on the bins, back on the bins in the end. So, yeah. Not that there's anything wrong with working on the bins, but when you've had about 15, 20 million quid, it's a bit of a come down.
Yeah, you're going back to where you were before. So, okay, you get your name back.
Yeah.
Aidan McGurran is back writing in print. So what's your role then? You go to East of England?
Yeah, I think for a little while I was doing general news from London, but then the East of England job came up, and so I took that, which is great, because it means it's kind of the best of both worlds, because you've got all all the breaking stories in that region, and also the opportunity to kind of plough your own furrow, build contacts, break exclusives.
So where are you based? Because that's quite a big patch.
Well, I was based where I live in Billericay, but obviously, yeah, you end up driving up to North Norfolk was always a bit of a pain. But you just went wherever the stories were. And also, over time, I became one of the more experienced news reporters on the paper. They'd send you abroad on other, you know, non-East of England-related stories as well.
What's the first big story you do as East of England reporter?
Well, one of the first really big ones that sticks in my mind, because it was so massive, was the Soham murders. Because that was absolutely huge at the time. And still resonates with people now, I think.
So tell me a little bit about that.
So it's, I think it was 2001. Two 10-year-old girls called Holly Wells and Jessica Chapman went for a walk. They'd been at Holly Wells' family's barbecue on a Sunday afternoon. They went for a walk in the village of Soham and were, well, what we now know, abducted and murdered. But at the time, it was regarded as a disappearance. It took 13 days for the bodies to be found. Subsequently transpired, they were murdered almost immediately by Ian Huntley, who was the caretaker of the Soham Village College. But for 13 days, there was a massive search, and you know, the publicity around the case was just extraordinary.
So what are you doing for those 2 weeks?
Those 2 weeks, well, actually, the first couple of days, I was on holiday in Spain, so I missed the first couple of days. I did offer to come back, and when the news editor at the time found out I was due back in a couple of days, said, no, stay there, but as soon as you're back, I want you up there. So I literally dropped the family back home, packed a bag, I went up to Newmarket. Just for the next, well, probably month or so, Burley left the Newmarket, Soham area. There's lots of press conferences and events, and just, you know, so there's lots of set piece events, but also just talking to people, getting the background on the families, and just filing ridiculous amounts of copies. I mean, it was one of those stories that it was August, and because the girls were only 10 and there was two of them, it just grabbed the attention of the nation, and it was never off the front page. It was just a massive, massive story.
Because there's just certain stories that capture the nation's interest.
Yeah.
I mean, you think more recently to the Nicola Bulley disappearance.
Yeah.
That was a wall-to-wall story, yeah, and people go missing every day. I suppose this one, I mean, my question for that was what makes that interesting and why that one? But this is obvious.
I mean,
you've got two
obvious,
girls who have gone missing.
Yeah. I mean, you know, they're very cute 10-year-old girls. They've gone missing, if you remember as well, there was a famous picture of them that took just before they went missing in the Man United tops. You know, so there's all these images that stay in people's minds. And, you know, I think, you know, I mean, at that time I had kids a little bit younger than those two. And I think, you know, if you've got kids or grandkids or anything, it's just horrific, the thought of it. And, you know, all they'd done is wandered off for a bit of a walk. They were getting some sweets from the village sports centre. And it was just horrific. And also, the families having to wait for like 2 weeks, nearly 2 weeks, until the bodies were found. It was just absolutely horrific.
Did you have to knock on the doors of the families?
No, there was quite strict rules in place at the time that we'd... I mean, the families did one or two media appearances, press conferences, etc., but we didn't bother them directly. There was people in the families, like, you know, uncles and stuff, who would also speak to the media from time to time, but no, we weren't bothering the families. They had enough to contend with without us being on the doorstep all the time.
Because what I refer to then is described often as a death knock.
Yeah.
And it's something that print journalists do
to
do.
What's
that like, doing it for the first time?
Horrific. I remember my first one to this day. It was a young man died in a car crash. I think he'd been on a fishing trip in North Wales or somewhere, and him and a few friends died in a car crash, and I was sent to knock on the family's door. I think I drove around the estate in my car for about 10 minutes, just trying to brace myself to do it. But it's one of those things, I mean, people... sometimes think we shouldn't do it, but as a journalist, it's one of those things that if you're going to be a journalist, you do have to do it. So, but it's not easy, you know. It's like, you know, at the end of the day, maybe, you know, people have certain opinions of tabloid journalists, but we are still human beings at the end of the day.
Yeah. So, how much are you sort of building a wall and thickening your skin so that these stories don't get to you?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of that. I mean, I think again, it's a bit almost like sort of social workers in a weird way, or they're completely different. In that, yeah, you have to distance yourself, and it might seem a bit kind of heartless in a way, but you kind of have to, because it gets you. I mean, like I say, the Soham thing was I found quite difficult because of the ages of the kids, my own kids' ages at the time. But I mean, the worst bit of that for me was, if you remember, one of the family liaison officers who'd worked with Jessica Chapman's family was arrested for possession of child pornography, and you know, so it's just like you just think can the world get any darker and more evil than that? So that I found that particular moment. I remember, actually, I'd literally got back home and I arrived on the drive of my car, and I had to put, the tip came from the office, actually. It did come to me, and I had to ring Cambridgeshire Police, who obviously I talk to all the time, and asked them if it was right. And I just assumed it was probably, you know, a lot of tips you get like that just turn out to be nonsense, that it was probably nonsense. And the press officer I spoke to, who I knew quite well, just went silent, and she said, "I'll have to call you back on that in a few minutes, Aidan." And I knew then straight away that it was true. Yeah.
And you know then that that's tomorrow's front page?
You also know that, yeah. Yeah, you do. Although at that particular moment, I was less excited about that. I was just more in the depths of despond at that point, thinking that the world was the darkest place I'd ever imagined it to be.
Let's do the next song then. Right. It's a good old Dolly Parton. Why are you picking this?
Well, I do love Dolly Parton. I think she's absolutely brilliant. And again, I think, you know, she's not always been given the credit she deserves. She takes the mick out of herself, which is nice. But I think she's a great artist and also a great philanthropist as well. You know, she does a work on literacy in the States and here. It's absolutely brilliant. So yeah, no, good tune.
My Life in Print with Aidan McGarrett. I'm Johnny Jenkins, and here's Coat of Many Colours on Gateway.
The seasons of my youth, I recall a box of rags that someone gave us, and how my mama put the rags to use. There were rags of many colors, but every piece was small, and I didn't have a coat, and it was away down in the fall. Mama sewed the rags together, so in every piece with love, she made my coat of many colors that I was so proud of. As she sewed, she told a story from the Bible she had read about a coat of many colors Joseph wore, and then she said, "Perhaps this coat will bring you good luck and happiness." And I just couldn't wait to wear it, and Mama blessed it with a kiss. My coat of many colors that my mama made for me, made only from rags, but I wore it so proudly. Although we had no money, well, I was rich as I could be. In my coat of many colors my mama made for me. On my breeches and holes in both my shoes, in my coat of many colors, I hurried off to school just to find the others laughing and making fun of me. In my coat of many colors my mama made for me, made just for me.
Dolly Parton's Coat of Many Colours. It's Gateway 97.8. I'm Johnny Jenkins. My Life in Print with Aidan McGurran, who rose to be the managing editor of Mirror Group newspapers. But now, as we speak, you're still the East of England reporter at the paper. Mm-hmm. In a moment, I want to hear a bit about Posh and Becks.
Fine.
But before we do that, if I say Suffolk Strangler, people know what that is, don't they?
Yeah, well, generally speaking, you know, a guy called Steve Wright, who killed in the space of about 6 weeks five sex workers in Ipswich. So again, it was pretty extraordinary because the fact so many victims died in such a short space of time, and actually, although they died over 6 weeks, all the bodies were found within the space of 10 days, just before Christmas. So it was a massive story. It's one I'm actually quite proud of in a way, though, because obviously there was comparisons with the Yorkshire Ripper because of the nature of many of the victims. But I look back at that coverage, and it was appalling. It was a very different age then, and you know, there's very little sympathy for the victims, the sex worker victims, as opposed to the innocent victims, supposedly. So what we did in terms of the Suffolk Strangler case, we put a lot of the focus on the victims and the fact that, you know, that although they were sex workers, they were from perfectly normal backgrounds. You know, the families were mourning them, all the rest of it. I mean, I think all of them had drug addiction problems and boyfriends with drug addiction problems, hence the working on the streets. But, we did try to present them in as positive a way as possible, rather than... Because the danger with murders is
you sort of glamorise them, can't you?
Yeah, that's the danger, that you end up glamorising the murderer. So we definitely didn't want to do that, and we wanted to give a voice to the victims and the victims' families as well.
I think now with all these true crime programmes and podcasts and everything, and people would just crave murder stories awful stories, and they glamorise them. It's quite concerning that that's such a big thing.
No, it is, and it's become massive, and books as well. But but like you say, now the amount of TV reenactment dramas, whatever, documentaries, and one thing I always find strange, that one of the biggest groups that seems to be fascinated with serial killers is teenage girls, which I always find a bit mystifying. But there you go. I mean, I was asked about doing a book on Soham and on the Ipswich murders, but I just never wanted to. I just felt that I'd written all the articles I did that that was it, and that it may sound hypocritical, but I felt it was a bit kind of exploitative, which may sound contradictory in a way. But I also felt that unless you have some insight that no one else has, and obviously I'd have knowledge that a lot of people wouldn't have, but I didn't think I had any genuine insight that no one else had, then, you know, it's just yet another book on a serial killer. I just didn't really fancy the idea of it.
No, in every great paper there's light and shade, isn't there? So not everything's heavy all the time. Yeah. And in that spirit, let's talk about David Beckham and Victoria Beckham, or Posh and Becks, as you would have called them quite a lot.
Yeah, I very rarely called them David and Victoria. Yeah, no, it's Posh and Becks. I was very lucky in that. So again, I was working in the east of England at the period that they moved into what became known as Beckingham Palace, and that was my exclusive story. I was very fortunate in that I had a really good contact, can't say too much about them, who had a lot of knowledge about what Posh and Becks were up to, so I got a lot of exclusives from that direction, including, like I said, one of the first really big ones was them buying what became known as Beckingham Palace.
So you hear what, that they've got a big place and you go and check it out for yourself?
Yeah, it was a weird one because it was literally that. They bought this big place, it's somewhere near Sawbridgeworth, but I don't know where. And it's like, right, okay. So I was like, right, where do I start? Fortunately, one of my colleagues knew a couple of estate agents in that area, so I spoke to them, and one of them was really helpful and said, initially he didn't know. He said, I'll put some feelers out. And then he rang me back and said he'd saw in some, you know, how things work, you know, the top end of the market. Apparently, I didn't know this at the time. The very top end of the market, rather than put something up officially for sale, what sometimes potential sellers do is do a feature with a property magazine showing the wonderful transformation they've made of this property. And in this case, it had been a children's home that this couple had bought and just completely done up, and done up very nicely, I have to say. And this had featured in some property magazine about a month earlier, and he said, I reckon that's it. So I went to see the people who were still living there, and got one of the most convincing denials ever from this couple, who's like, you know, denied any knowledge of Victoria and David Beckham at all. I can't remember how I stood it up in the end, but I did stand it up about a day or two later despite that, and literally within a couple of days of me appearing in the paper, they'd moved in. So yeah, I was very pleased with that one.
I don't suppose they were so pleased.
I don't think they were that pleased at all, no. But I mean, inevitably, I mean, having said that, I think the Beckhams are savvy enough to know that it was only a matter of time before it would get out. So yeah, it's just probably a little bit quicker than they were hoping. They'd have probably liked to have done an exclusive with Hello Magazine first.
So you telling the story there, I suppose, explains to someone what a journalist actually does. Mm-hmm. You hear something, or you find out a little bit of information, you talk to contacts which you are constantly building up and developing and piece it all together. How important are those sort of web of contacts?
Yeah, no, really important. I mean, you know, I think that's the difference between an okay reporter and a really good reporter, that you have a real decent quantity of contacts in different areas, so providing different types of stories as well. I mean, like I said, when I worked at The Sun, there was the chief reporter at The Sun was a guy called John Kay. He's passed away a couple of years ago now, sadly, and his contacts were just phenomenal. Absolutely phenomenal. But he never lost his enthusiasm for breaking great exclusives. So again, he was a real inspiration. You can't beat a decent set of contacts.
And they're vast. There's people from all walks of life. And you might only talk to these people once or twice a year, but they've got to be able to want to give you something, haven't they?
Yeah, and I think people assume it's always about money. It often is, I'm not going to lie, but not always. Sometimes people just like... breakers, obviously they might have a grudge against their employer or whatever, all sorts of reasons. But sometimes what you have to do, sometimes though, you have to be really careful with contacts because they can get a bit carried away. So one of the things I would always say to people is, how many people know about this? And if it was literally two or three, it's like, well, wait a while, because it'll be too obvious.
You need to protect
them from themselves sometimes, yeah. But obviously, because like I say, they can unwittingly draw attention to themselves and make it obvious where the stories are coming from, and that's the last thing you want from their point of view and from your point of view.
But why do they want to talk to the paper in the first place?
It varies. I mean, like I say, financial motivation is a big part of it. You know, back in the day, I'm talking about, you know, The Sun and The Mirror had big budgets, would pay big fees for tip-offs and stories. So that's part of it. But like I say, sometimes people just like doing it.
Let's hear another song then. Dexy's Midnight Runners. Why have you picked this one?
Again, big fan of Kevin Rowland, and the lyrics appeal to me a lot. I grew up, like I said, my dad was Irish, and in the 70s and 80s, there was a lot of sort of anti-Irish sentiment that came to the surface at that time, and so this song meant a lot to me because it's quite proudly pro-Irish.
And it's called Burn It Down. Here we go. Down from the Dexys at Midnight Runners. This is Johnny Jenkins on Gateway 97.8, My Life in Print, with Aidan McGurran, who's with me in the studio. Aidan, one of the big stories around here that people still are obsessed with is the Michael Barrymore, Stuart Lubbock saga. So where does that start for you as a reporter?
Well, it starts with the tragic death of Stuart Lubbock himself. I think, if I remember correctly, it happened on a Saturday night, and news broke first thing Sunday morning, so I was dispatched to Michael Barrymore's place near Harlow, and it started from there. And I think one of the reasons people are obsessed with it was two reasons, or two main reasons. Barrymore, people perhaps forget, was absolutely huge. He was the king of light entertainment. Never a big fan personally, but he was, and it just crashed his career completely. And also the death of Stuart Lubbock, we still don't really know exactly what happened and how responsible or not Michael Barrymore was for that.
It's funny that, because it's a story which hasn't ended yet.
No, No. And, you know, again, I mean, it's a very sad story on all sorts of levels, because Terry Lubbock, Stuart's dad, you know, for years and years wanted answers, and actually met Michael Barrymore, which I think was something he bitterly regretted, because he just felt Barrymore was using it as a PR opportunity and didn't really want to genuinely answer what had happened, what hadn't happened. So, I mean, it's very sad, you know, because not only did a young man lose his life, but the family's never really been given an explanation as what happened and why.
Just how many people there on the night? 3, 4?
No, it was a bit more than that. I'm trying to remember. About 8 or 9.
Okay, because I'm just trying to work out how you get a story out of something if so few people are there.
Yeah, well, obviously the police did release some information. There were one or two people that had been there that did speak about it. Inevitably, what happens is some of the people spoke to other people who then spoke to the newspapers about what happened. But what had happened on that evening is, I think Barrymore and a few of his friends had been out to a nightclub in Harlow and met various people, Stuart Lubbock and several others, who then went back to the house and carried on proceedings there. And unfortunately, Stuart Lubbock died in the swimming pool, it would appear.
Gateway 97.8 with Johnny. More in a moment. Next, though, Nina Simone's Strange Fruits. Why this one?
Well, I mean, Nina Simone's a fantastic artist, and it's just an extraordinary song, very brave song. Actually, when I first heard it, it was the UB40's version I first heard. It was on their first album, but then later heard Nina Simone's version. It's just an incredible song.
7 feet barren, strange fruit, blood on the leaves, and blood at the roots. Black bodies swinging in the southern breeze. Strange fruit hanging from the poplar trees. Pastoral scene of the gallant South. Them big bulging eyes and the twisted mouth. Scent of magnolia, clean and fresh. Then the sudden smell of burning. Here is a fruit for the crows to pluck. For the rain to gather, for the wind to suck, for the sun. Here is a strange and bitter cry.
Nina Simone's Strange Fruit, Gateway 97.8. I'm Johnny Jenkins with Aidan McGurran. This is My Life in Print. Just speaking there a moment ago about Michael Barrymore, sometimes you've written so much about someone who's so key to a story, and then you've got to come face to face with them.
Yeah, no, well, it was quite extraordinary how that happened with Michael Barrymore. So a couple of years after the death of Stuart Lubick, he was trying to revive his career. I think he was appearing in Panto in the Midlands or somewhere, and we actually arranged to do via official channels, via his PR company, to do an interview with him. But my brief was basically to ask him, did he feel responsible for the death of Stuart Lubick? So obviously asked all the soft, nicey questions at first. Realised at some point I've got to ask this one. And when I finally did ask it, I think the photographer thought I'd bottle it, but I didn't. I asked it, and it's fair to say, Michael Barrymore's face contorted with rage. I actually thought he was going to attack me, but it's fair to say he was not happy. That's for sure.
And you've got to shake hands at the end and move on, or maybe you didn't.
I don't think we shook hands after that one.
I suppose. Fair enough. Okay, we will finish in a moment on a foreign assignment which dominated the news internationally. But I suppose everything changed after 9/11, and security is so tight everywhere then.
Yeah, massively so, yeah. Again, one of the exclusives I'm quite proud of was that a couple of weeks after 9/11, we got a tip-off at the Mirror about a security lapse at Stansted Airport. So basically, we were told that where they do the basically service the passenger jets, for want of a better expression, there's no security checks taking place. You could walk in and out. So I donned a pair of overalls and with a couple of guys who had given us the information and a photographer, and sure enough walked straight in, walked onto a passenger jet. And I'll always remember the worst moment of this particular story was the photographer. It was the early days of the digital cameras, mm-hmm. mini digital cameras, and he wasn't used to it. So we're in an aircraft in an aircraft hangar. And the flash goes off. It was like all the Blackpool illuminations going off at once. But fortunately, security was so lax that no one seemed to notice that either. So the next day, it was the first 7 pages of the Daily Mirror, and Piers Morgan was a very happy guy, it's fair to say.
Because for a story to not just get, front page or a couple of pages, 7 pages, I mean, it's a big deal, isn't it?
Yeah, no, it was a big deal. Although the local Conservative MP, but for some reason one of your competitors, BBC Radio Essex, mm-hmm. seemed to decide that it wasn't much of a story and it was a bit of a stunt, so they actually got me on to be interviewed and basically said, but British Airports Authority are saying this, that and the other. And I said, well, they would say that, but Piers Morgan has just given it 7 pages in the Daily Mirror, so it's quite an important security story as far as we're concerned. And later on that day, they trotted out the local Conservative MP to also slag me off, and they actually asked him, do you think people like Aidan McGurran should be arrested? And I always remember his reply, it made me laugh. He said, I often think people like Aidan McGurran should be arrested, but in this particular instance, he was exposing a serious security lapse.
You get these international incidents which just capture the attention of the whole world, basically. Yeah. And as a British newspaper, you've got to make sure you've got someone out there. And so you get sent off to Hurricane Katrina.
Yeah, out of the blue. Wasn't expecting that call. We were lucky at the Mirror in that our US editor actually arrived in New Orleans just before the hurricane hit, because it was widely anticipated there was going to be a hurricane. We didn't know what effect it would have, we didn't anticipate it being as devastating as it was. So I was sent to join him a day or two later. I had to drive from Houston, Texas to New Orleans, which is quite a way.
So how long did that take?
About 12 hours. And also, the thing was, it was like such a really exhausted journey anyway. But then knowing that there was a way into New Orleans, but we weren't quite sure what that involved, and obviously most of it was underwater, so it was quite a stressful one. So you wanted to make sure you got there before it went dark, that's for sure. Anyway, we just about managed it. Had a very big 4x4 that got us through quite a bit of flood water.
And then you've got to deal with a world you don't necessarily know, and you don't know where you're going, and you don't know where you are. And
yeah, no, well, it was a weird one, and nothing worked. All the electricity was out, mobile phone network was down. There was literally, we were staying in what had been a hotel, it was pretty much devastated, where the the governor and his staff were based, and there was literally like one floor of this hotel where you could get a mobile phone signal. So in order to send any copy or do anything...
So you're filing it back over the phone?
Yeah. Well, via laptop, but using your mobile phone to send.
I see. There we are. We've raced through, and it does feel like we've raced through your 20-year career at the Mirror. What's the sort of proudest number one moment for you?
I think lasting 20 odd years at the Mirror is probably one of them. I mentioned the Ipswich murders, the way we handled that. I think that was a cause of pride. Things like the security lapses at Stansted Airport that, you know, did probably change things and how things were done. That's a cause of pride. And it sounds a bit sentimental, but being at the Mirror, because of the values of the Mirror that stood for, I always felt that it was on the side of the ordinary working person. You know, we never pandered to racism or any form of discrimination, anything like that. So, you know, yeah, it's just... I still am proud to describe myself as a Mirror man, even though technically I'm not anymore.
Your advice to someone starting now?
If you really want to do it, go for it. There'll be a lot of people telling you not to, telling you that the industry's dead or dying. But we've been saying that for a long time. Newspapers may or may not exist in the near future, but there will always be a place for news.
And why should someone pick up a paper today?
You're asking the wrong and the right person at the same time. I just love newspapers. I will always love newspapers. I still buy my Daily Mirror every single day, or Sunday Mirror on Sundays. I just think it's a great form. But that said, you know, I also look at news online, TV news, radio news, all the rest of it. You know, like I said, my dad was a bit of a news junkie, and I seem to have taken after him in that respect.
Finally then, do you want to tell us why you've picked Tainted Love by Gloria Jones?
Yeah, I do, because not a lot of people probably won't be familiar with this version. This was the original. Gloria Jones, this song basically did nothing when it was first released. Gloria Jones is best known as being Mark Bolan's girlfriend, but it's became a bit of a Northern Soul classic, and growing up in the part of the world that I did, you know, Northern Soul was a big part of my youth.
Gateway978.com for the full schedule. My Life in Print with Ada McGurran.
on your mobile apps on 97.8 and now on DAB. This is Gateway.
From the sky.